You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation with John Best.
Welcome, everybody. This is Glenn Servati and John Best from the Big Cast.
From a very, very active few days here.
At the
Mall of America. We literally can walk right into it, right down the hall.
I have done it many, many times. It's like a biodome. You can come here and literally never leave.
A little bit like Las Vegas. I've done that a few times.
Yeah, there's nothing. Let's say you need a hat. There are 7 lid stores. Let's say you need a Starbucks. There's 8 of those. It's amazing.
But it's also June in Minneapolis, which is a perfect time to be here.
Why would you stay inside? That's absolutely true.
And this is obviously the AXFI conference we're talking
about. AXFI 2019. We just announced AXFI 2020.
This was the sixth year?
Sixth year, yep.
And a big change this year that we have a new partner, Trellence. Having acquired OnApproach, and
right.
They agreed, they were excited about being involved and very excited about keeping this thing going.
We're so lucky. They not really lucky, but we're blessed that Tom Davis and Erica and the group at Trellence really saw the value in this conference. They're actually, I believe, shutting down their immersion conference, which you and I spoke at once.
Yes, I was there this year.
There were interpretive dancers and lots of stuff, if I remember right. They're really going to go all in on this conference. So what a blessing. Just an amazing week. I wasn't sure how this was all going to play out, but I could really feel from pretty much everyone here just the energy. And
it's a big change.
It's a big change. I was concerned about it, but it stuck to it. I believe it's here. So we started this conference. I think it was 5. I think we're in the fifth year. I think it's the fifth year.
I think it's the fourth for me.
The first one I've done of these was just a round table with I think maybe 10, 12 people in the room. Second one was a little bigger. There might have been 20, 30. And that's when I went to Paul and said, let's blow this thing out. I want to add innovation as a track. And Paul, to his credit, said, I'm in. And here we are.
Well, that does mean there's 6 because I was not at any of that. They were that small.
Okay.
I think I've been to 4 of them. So.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But then you get some very high profile speakers here as well this time. And we started off right off the day, kicked off with Jim Maroos.
Jim Maroos.
From the financial brand.
The legend. The financial brand. He told the story of the financial brand, which was amazing. He's looking good. Yeah,
I I've seen him speak, I think, 3 or 4 times already this year, which really made me wonder, was I going to hear enough new stuff? And he is great at mixing things up.
He sure is.
And he has got real-time information. And one of the things we talked about was Chase shutting down their Finn digital banking offering.
And it was a unique perspective. He shared that, what does that mean if, an organization like Chase looks at this boutique kind of banking offering and shuts it down, and how does it play into it? And I thought that was interesting, dovetailed with Brian Lay's comment that, 23% of all the new accounts that are open go to Chase.
That's
interesting.
Amazing. So, well, a couple of different angles on that I forget if it was Jim that said this or if I read it someplace else online. It's still that challenge of a legacy organization trying to get comfortable with what they're going to do with a new digital offering. Because one of the problems, as I understand it, is Finn was hamstrung that they did not market any place that Chase had a physical presence.
Right.
They really only did their heavy marketing where Chase was not active in the market with physical brick and mortar branches. When you're Chase, that's going to limit a lot of what you can do.
Yeah.
The other thing that I hadn't really put 2 and 2 together on was another similar situation going back, well back in time. This probably was 2002, Wingspan.
Yep, Wingspan.
Again, which was first USA, which lo and behold wound up being acquired by Bank One and then by Chase.
Right.
And then got shut down again.
Yeah.
So.
There was Bluebird.
Mm-hmm.
Similar concept with American Express. So we've seen a lot of tries in this space.
But Wingspan, the interesting thing was, like Finn, they seem to be getting some traction.
Oh, they had like 3 million, right away. So he also kind of, put out some doom and gloom, or at least an idea of doom and gloom, his Amazon concept.
I love that. I thought that was a great idea. The idea of, and it could be done by a credit union, but the challenge is they're going to look for someone big to go big. But, why couldn't a bank bundle a checking account offering with Amazon Prime?
We could do it. If they take the money out and you go, hey, as long as you got us and Amazon, we'll pay for your Prime every month. You see it come through. And then you just reimburse them for it.
Yeah. It's a little bit like American Express does with a certain amount of Uber or Lyft rides.
Right. Exactly.
One of the things he mentioned, and this is kind of an example, but I think he's talking more about the artificial intelligence, was I jotted down the note that consumers are looking for their banks to, quote unquote, make me a better me. Use what you know about me to help nudge me in the right direction, which I'll just, you know, point people back again to last week's episode I did with Operation Hope and Mary L. Beasley from the Duke University Common Sense Lab, which is exactly the whole behavioral economics, social behavior, you know, angle that they're trying to do, as they call it, hacking human behavior. And figuring out a way to get people to do what they probably already know they should do. They just need an added push.
Well, you know why toothpaste tingles when you brush your teeth?
Is it the sodium lauryl sulfate?
Do you think you need it?
It just makes you feel like you're accomplishing something?
Ah. Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg. Read it.
Wow.
Great. And so
Listerine got all over that.
But that's absolutely hacking.
I hate it, but I love it.
You hack the human, you know. They realized that when that didn't have that ending point to feel like they accomplished something. You're right on.
I don't know if you were the one that brought him into the conversation as well, but kicking off our second day, Patrick Schwertfeger.
Yes,
Was he somebody that you knew from past life?
No, not at all. I hadn't met him, but I read about him online. I pointed him out, and wow, what an incredible opportunity we had. He was really good. I liked it because he was not a financial futurist. He was really kind of an overall futurist and pointing out trends across basically human society, I guess, across industry. It was good.
Really nice guy, too. As a matter of fact, after his presentation, I just happened to track him down in the hallway. And lo and behold, we've got an interview with him.
Well, let's listen.
Let him speak for himself.
All right.
Glenn Cervata here at AXFI with Patrick Schwertfeger, a futurist from the Bay Area, I believe, correct?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Vancouver, lived in the Bay Area for 18 years, and now I'm down in Newport Beach, California.
You're a Canadian. You never use the word process, so
yeah,
I didn't
process. Oh, I've learned to speak like a Yankee.
You've assimilated. Okay. You gave a presentation this morning on embracing disruptive innovation, which I think is extremely topical for this audience, and several nuggets that I just thought were really great. So was happy to run into you in the hallway and managed to buttonhole you here in a conference room and get a quick conversation going.
Yeah, it's a good topic to cover. You know, most people are really intimidated by the disruptive innovation, and for good reason. But the fact is that there is an opportunity amidst that. If other companies are faltering or even failing, someone's going to take their place. Someone can go in there and take that revenue. And I think that's the mindset people should have, is to stay on offense rather than defense.
The one piece that it jumped out at me, and obviously relevant, very specific to this marketplace, was your ATM example, where the number of tellers employed in the U.S. actually rose after the ATM machine was
introduced. You know, that's a fascinating, because you can contrast that with travel agents. So in the ATM, this happened in the early 80s, and everyone kind of assumed that all these tellers in banks would all lose their jobs. And you're right, the exact opposite thing ended up happening. It's not that they grew dramatically, but they continued to grow at a slower rate.
You showed the curve. I mean, it's not down. It's a very low increase. But the fact that I don't think anybody would have guessed it was going to be increasing. But the reason for that, I thought, was fascinating.
Yeah, and this applies, you know, these are models that we can use to look at different industries. So it turns out that when you take the basic transactions, like withdrawals, deposits, and automate those through the ATMs, then the tellers that are left do strategic activities, and there's fewer tellers per branch, which means that the break even of opening a new branch drops. That's the key. So if the break even, if the cost of opening a branch drops, all of a sudden banks could see it was financially viable and profitable to open branches in all sorts of different neighborhoods.
Whereas creates a need for new tellers.
Exactly. So there's fewer tellers per branch, but more overall. And 30 years ago, you know, if you want to go to a bank, you had to go to the downtown, the city center. And today there's branches all over the place. And that's one of the primary reasons why. So, but then you have to contrast that against the travel agents, where the increase in technology has directly reduced the number of agents. So when you have a new technology, the question we have to ask is this going to evolve like travel agents, where a reduced break even allows us to have a larger footprint? Or is it going to be travel agents, where literally these jobs are likely to be displaced forever?
You've hit on a sore point, because I grew up in the travel. My father ran travel agencies.
Oh my gosh.
He managed to get out in time, and he actually did corporate travel,
kidding.
You know, he did get out before the bottom.
And that was a lagging piece. So the B2C space always goes first, and then the B2B comes second. So the retail, the B2C travel agents, they got displaced first. And the corporate travel folks still had kind of an extended lease on life, but even they are dropping today. So,
and it was interesting too, because it actually, to me, added in another angle that you talked about with the, this is no, not rocket science, the repetitive versus the non-repetitive tasks.
Yeah.
It's the repetitive tasks that wind up being replaced by robotics,
yeah,
algorithms, things like that. And one thing that, you know, I have just enough connection still to the travel industry, cruise lines, very kind of customized vacations,
yeah,
those people still do a good job. Those are non-repetitive tasks.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything that's just a straight booking. Yeah.
But it's even there. Like, how do you define a repetitive task? Like, that in itself is a moving line.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's considered repetitive today, like tomorrow. So technology consistently, effectively, it climbs a ladder of complexity. So it's able to do more and more complex things. So things that we would have thought are non-repetitive or too sophisticated 10 years ago, all of a sudden today, the machines can do it. Well, what happens in another 10 years from now? And I would argue that the difference in the next 10 years is going to far exceed the difference of the last 10 years.
As you pointed out with the genome project, where it took the first, 7 years to...
Yeah, 1%.
The first, yeah.
Yeah, and then once you kind of get the hang of it, all of a sudden the whole thing just goes all at once. So, and that happens in one industry after another. So again, you get that dichotomy of, you know, the threat of having your business disrupted on the one hand, but the opportunity for new revenue opportunities on the other.
Makes sense. The other point that you made, that, again, seen it before, but put in the proper context, the tenure of the average time spent of a company on the S&P 500, which is, I forget the exact numbers. I don't know if you have
it. Yeah, I don't know if I have it exactly right.
Dropping dramatically.
Yeah, well, apparently it used to be like 65 years. And again, if I'm wrong, I could easily, I'm trying to remember if I had that number correctly. But it was in that range. And today, I think it's 14.
I think you said 14. Yeah, I remember
and
that.
And it's dropping. And there's a study from Washington University that said that 40% of S&P companies could be gone by 2026.
Which is not surprising given that trend, as you say.
Yeah, but who's going to take their place? Like all these big companies failing, these are huge buckets of revenue. That potentially
are going to... Presumably the revenue doesn't go away.
Exactly.
Elsewhere. And which, you know, it kind of gets back to, you know, the topic of income inequality and whatnot, where you talk about people in the top fifth and the lower fifth.
That, well, for sure.
You know, there's no rule that says the top 20% have to be the same top 20% forever.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is when they don't move back and forth. So, you know, obviously there's a desire for self-preservation, but it's probably a fairly healthy thing that it's not the exact same S&P 500 company.
Yeah, I mean, the more churn you have in the economy, the more egalitarian it's going to be.
It gets nerve-wracking, but egalitarian.
It's nerve-wracking, but it's egalitarian. So you have success stories, you have new wealth, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is also the difference between a growing population and a stagnant or declining population, as in Germany and Japan. Expanding populations, you have new neighborhoods, new gas stations, new restaurants, new shopping malls, new. There's new people, builders,
mm-hmm,
right? So these are new people making money, first generation wealth, right? And then, you know, in the other situation where you've got zero growth populations, you don't need new stores, you don't need new roads, you don't need new gas stations. What you have is enough. So whoever owns those existing businesses, they continue to do well and earn a profit while everyone else kind of stays the same. So you have this widening division between rich and poor, and mathematically that's going to get a lot worse in the years to come.
And tying that to a presentation I saw at a financial inclusion seminar just a couple weeks ago, just barely over 50%, but over half of the U.S. banking deposits are held by people aged 50 and over. Well, you know, wow, they're past their prime spending years. They're not. Yeah. They're no longer buying new houses, raising kids and whatnot. So that money is available for deployment, but it's not immediately, as you say, from the next generation moving on and doing
things.
That's
interesting. Yeah, they say that the peak spending year in a person's life is year 47.
That's even later than I would have thought. I was going to guess more like 38, 40 or so.
Well, so it's you know, I'm 48 already, but the 37 people quite often still have a mortgage. They might still be paying off for a car, and they're putting their kids through college at that point many times. So there's a lot of money. Again, this is
I was including the college spending in my calculations. Okay,
yeah,
that's what you're saying then.
So,
it's discretionary spend. Yeah,
it is amazing when you look across a population. Again, there's wild variations between one person and another, but across the whole population, what was the gentleman's name? There was a book that came out in the '90s by an author who lives in Oakland, which was all about this. I can't remember the name of it, but in any case, the impact, you know, the baby boom generation, for example, and their peak spending years, that was really the reason of the boom in the 90s, yeah. is that they were all going through that 47 age period. And then Generation X, which is 13% smaller, I'm in the middle of that generation. Of course, that results in softness in the economy. And then when the millennials start hitting that age, which starts in about 10 years, that's when things start to really pick up again.
Was that the same book? No, it might have been. I'm thinking of Freakonomics, actually, had an example with the lowering of the crime rate. That it wasn't necessarily...
Yeah,
you know,
a lot of that was population.
It was the age, the demographic bubble of time that people are just tending to cause more...
Well, baby booms. I mean, baby booms result in volatility 17 years later, because we're talking about, like, teenage, early 20s men who... have tons of testosterone and not good jobs yet, you know, financially frustrated. So they lash out at the source of their perceived injustice. And when we did that with the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s. Meanwhile, South Asia, Middle East, they've had a baby boom. And who do they lash out? They lash out at their source of perceived injustice, which was to a large extent religion-based, Israel and the West and so on. So arguably the entire terrorism phenomena was a function of the baby boom demographic situation in that part of the world. And now those birth rates have dropped, and sure enough, that volatility is moderating. And where is it today? It's in Africa, where the birth rate is still very high. So the future of terrorism likely will be Al-Shabaab and all the folks in Africa, where the birth rate is still
not the
high.
Topic I was expecting to get into.
No,
but
these things are very interesting. You can map these things into the future. You can see where the volatility is going to be. A lot of it, you know, the age profile, where you have only a few adults and a lot of young people, is very volatile because adults are a moderating influence.
Yeah.
So in Europe and Japan and France, where it's more like the same number of adults as children, that it creates a moderating influence and more mature situation. And you can see these things across the different nations
really
around the world.
About that, Mike. This is exactly what I suspected would happen. There's just so many different angles we can go into. We could probably make a whole podcast out of this. But one other thing that I think is specific to the financial technology space that you touched on, and it kind of goes right into what you're kind of referring to with the pyramid of ages and whatnot.
Yeah.
You made the point that, you know, if you look at it's the people at the lower end of the pyramid financially that are looking for simpler, less expensive solutions. Whereas, you know, a lot of the sexy kind of financial development is appealing to the affluent. That's frankly where the money is, at least in the perception.
Yeah.
But your point is that a lot of the innovation takes place at that lower mass market side.
Yeah, the disruptive innovation tends to cater to the least profitable market segment first. So those are the people you describe who are kind of at the bottom of the pyramid. And they're the customers that you hate, honestly. You're like, oh, gosh, these people have no money. They're
the ones that in theory are costing you when you do the supposed analysis of lifetime value. If they're not ever going to get rich, they probably are going to cost you money.
Yeah, and a lot of their lost leaders down at the bottom. And a lot of times you're like, gosh, if someone would take them off from your hands, like, you'd almost be happy about it. Meanwhile, and you're right what you said just a moment ago, what they're looking for across the board is simpler, less expensive solution. And if someone comes up with something that is simpler, less expensive, and it gains traction down in those bottom ranks where no one's looking because they're a pain in the neck, if it gains traction there, it can sweep up through the whole thing all at once, and you don't even notice it coming because that's not where your focus is. You know, they call it institutional blindness. Like, even within 3 weeks, you can become very focused on what's happening within your industry, within your company, right? And you get very focused on that center, so much so that you miss what's happening right outside your industry, or below or above or whatever it is. And all that's why these businesses get caught off guard. These are very smart, well-educated people with tons of experience. And meanwhile, they miss it sometimes because it's not where they're focused. My phone's beeping away. I apologize.
It's a busy man.
Text messages.
Well, that's great. And you kind of touched on this again. You've got a book. I mean, we could go on in great detail. I assume this is also covered. You've got a book, Anarchy's in the title. I forget the exact title.
Yeah, it's Anarchy, Inc., Profiting in a Decentralized World with Artificial Intelligence and Blockchain. If you pan out as far as you can, in the trend perspective, one of the largest ones that's unfolding kind of everywhere is a trend from centralized power structures to decentralized power structures.
Fostered in part by social media.
Absolutely.
You can't control the single point
of content. Blockchain is a big piece of that. But there's a lot of these. Now, there's some exceptions where, the people who own platforms are getting more powerful, like Google and those are the platform economy. That's a big piece.
Yep.
But in terms of the amount of options and power effectively that average citizens have, it's getting higher and higher and higher. So, you know, I'm optimistic about the future. I think it's extremely exciting and there's a lot of opportunity, but it's going to be a wild ride.
Yeah.
And we're just seeing the beginnings of that even politically. The discourse is going to get worse, not better. So it's going to be not easy for the next 10, 15 years.
So if people want to find out more, I know you've got a website that's set up for the book, correct? And that's the best way to get in touch with you?
My main website is patrickschwartfeger.com, but the easiest way to get there is just to go to bookpatrick.com, and that will forward to the full URL because my last name's really tricky.
He's 13 letters, only 3 vowels.
Yeah, all E's. It's a crazy. But if you go to bookpatrick.com, you can find out about what I do, how I spend my time, and also my book is featured there on the homepage.
I will make sure we post that link to the website as well.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Patrick Schwartfeger, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, sir.
One of the things I did a little bit of research after that and checked with my friends, because Peter's data around the number of tellers actually ended at 2010. It has reduced significantly since then, but I don't think that disproves his point. In fact, if anything, it supports it, because what's happened since then? Branches have started declining again for an entirely different reason. His point about the effect of ATMs actually creating more branches made sense. Now it's an entirely different effect. So the level of teller employment is down over the course of the last 9 years by about 20% total, which is really not that big on a year-to-year basis, and is projected to drop by another 8% over the course of the next several years.
I also thought that his jobs displayed by a displaced.
Oh, that's
AI.
Right. The very top one.
The
that
top
he listed.
One was loan officers. What does that mean?
I mean, and then that gets back to his whole notion about, you know, the jobs, the repeatable tasks and the non-repeatable tasks. Well, in a lot of cases, I think there's always going to be some level of overlay where you want someone to look at it, but the vast majority of what the loan officer is doing can probably be automated.
So interesting.
Speaking of disturbing things, Peter Singer, who I thought was really interesting, talking about the cyber threatscape from the New America Foundation.
Yep, and he actually has a book called Like War, which is really talking about the social aspect, what the foreign countries, the foreign actors would call active measures. And he really brought it home with a lot of stuff.
Had you heard that phrase, AstroTurf movement, before? I hadn't.
Yeah, I'd heard that. It's basically, AstroTurf is...
It's a play on grassroots movement.
Yeah, it's a fake grassroots movement. His Tennessee GOP one was very interesting. So he showed us these sites that where people had created... Basically, I mean, the Tennessee GOP one had more followers than the regular GOP.
By a factor of about 7.
Right. It had literally 100,000 followers. And it was all fake. It was all something that somebody put together. So it's really manipulating our culture. And it's interesting. There's actually a really interesting documentary on it.
Oh, really?
Called Active Measures that I highly recommend you seek out, that talks about, hey, when you can't afford to keep up with your foe in terms of weapons, then... You turn to weapons that are more economical. Well, this is the most economical weapon you can have. All you're really doing is getting involved in the culture and trying to shift it in a way that makes that's beneficial for you.
The one example I thought was fascinating was the whole notion of Lady Gaga fans, who are pretty zealous in terms of defending their girl.
So basically, Lady Gaga had had The Star Is Born has come out, and Lady Gaga fans decided to use the same tactics that the Russians used, sort of hack our election to make her movie the number one movie.
Which was funny, because there was the what they perceived as the top competition was actually a movie that got just trashed.
Right. Which one?
Venom? I don't even remember.
I just watched it last night.
Okay.
Because they said
probably
that.
Planted the seed. And did it suck?
I liked it.
Oh, well. Did you like A Star Is Born?
I liked that too. Okay, I liked them both.
Did you like Russia?
No, but Active Movements was good. Active Measures was good. I think you should watch that.
Well, and another guy that was had a scary message, particularly about the ability for us to continue to keep the secrets through crypto, Roger Grimes, actually spoke a couple of different times. And the one message he did at the keynote was around quantum computing. And I think that one just blew my mind. That's more your territory. So I'm going to let you talk about that one.
Well, first of all, there's a whole podcast with us. If you haven't listened to
you
it,
and Roger talked a few times.
Definitely link to that in the show notes. But the idea that quantum computing will create a computing, I think when he put it the best, he said, hey, if you were trying to crack this encryption algorithm, you'd need all the computing power on the planet, and you would need, 150 million years. And he literally said that. And then he said, but a quantum computer could do it in seconds.
But I just love the the particle and the quantum computer can both be first in the list,
right,
and last.
Well, it's a qubit, and the thing about a qubit, so a regular bit, its properties are either binary, right? So it's a zero or one. That's how computers work.
This could be a zero and a one.
Right. This could be, it could be a bunch of zeros and a bunch of ones. It could simultaneously be true and false.
I was back in a dorm room at 1 a.m. listening to this. This is a great lead into our cannabis banking episode next week.
Yeah. But what the takeaway from it was that it'll enable AI. It's really the next kind of nuclear weapon, if you will. Once someone gets to what they call quantum supremacy, now they could go through and break the encryption, like the SSL encryption that protects our browsers, right? They could break the encryption that's protecting money transmissions between banks. And where we ended was, I think I took a poll of the audience and said, hey, how many of you know what level of encryption your VPNs are using, or what level of encryption your email's using, or what level of encryption your transmissions are using back to the Fed? And the answer was really, we don't. And the crypto advocacy, ooh, I just made a new word. I think that I walked away from that is, it's time to do a crypto inventory. And there's not a lot of people who can do that. Actually, we at Big are talking about, well, we're not talking about, we can help. We have a CISSP, we have me, I'm a crypto guy. It's time for you to sit down. It doesn't mean that this is going to happen tomorrow, but it could be.
It's closer than people think.
Yeah, it's not 10 years away, like everybody thought.
And you don't want to get caught flat-footed.
Right, because it's going to be an event like a Y2K event where...
Yeah, he was comparing it to Y2K, in which people joke about it. But the bottom line is, one of the reasons there wasn't an event is because people prepared for it.
They took it seriously,
it's
yeah.
It's like, you know, oh my God, you were an idiot for buying insurance because nothing happened.
Yeah,
no, that's not really the way it works.
My favorite piece of the quantum is, you can't look at the answer because you'll change the answer.
That was, again, dorm room 1 a.m. And that was kind of more the futurist. And again, not that far out in the future, but that was the futurist presentation Roger did. He also did a breakout about 10 ways that I can hack your email.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one that I actually tracked him down and had a conversation.
So he's really good.
And that's what it's something, some here and now stuff you can take away. Let's have a listen.
He has a book on cryptography, too. Just we'll throw it in the notes.
We have several. Yeah, he's got a couple books, and I think we mentioned them.
Glenn Cervata here, finding a quiet corner at the AXFI conference in Minneapolis with Roger Grimes, who is the author of 10 books, I think you said.
10 books.
And many, many magazine articles. Hacking the Hacker, one of the ones that I think is best known. Been in the computer defense industry now for 32 years, I think you said. And also the data-driven defense evangelist for KnowBe4 Corporation.
Yep.
Thanks for taking the time. I know you're going to be speaking this afternoon, and we're actually competing with each other at the same time on the conference. So I think you've got a sexier topic than I do. Hacking the Hacker, 10 ways I can hack you using email, which I think is going to be great at getting people's attention. And you point out in your notes that you find email exploits a particularly interesting area. Can you talk a bit about why you find that to be the case?
Sure. And actually, the talk is it really should be called 10 Very Interesting Ways I Can Hack You via Email. 70-90% of all malicious data breaches occur because of phishing and social engineering.
I know, and you're not going there.
Yeah.
You're going.
So the reality is, even after when I show this talk, it scares the heck out of people.
Yeah.
They freak out. But I tell people, hey, all this all added together really is maybe 1% of the hacks. You really have to be worried about phishing, number one. But the attacks that I show, like probably one of the most interesting hacks, is that I can send you an email that you either just open in preview mode, or maybe I trick you into clicking on a link, and it sends me your Windows password hash, which I can then crack and log into your system or other systems on your network.
One of the things I jotted down, the whole notion of hash theft. Again, not coming at it from the technical side. Can you explain that a bit more? I mean, that's the way passwords are actually stored behind the scenes?
Yeah, so in most authentication systems, they don't store your plain text password. They obfuscate them using some type of hash. Could be, SHA-1, or in Windows, it's LM hash or NT hash. In the Linux world, MD5, which is kind of older, or bcrypt, something called bcrypt.
Okay.
But those hashes, if you can capture them as an attacker, you can try to crack them or convert them back to their plain text equivalent. And on a Windows network, you can actually replay them across the network without even cracking them, no matter how long or big your password is. Even if you use smart cards or two-factor authentication or biometrics, really behind the scenes, even when you don't use a password inside of a Windows network, it really is storing this password hash that you either know about or don't know about. And if an attacker can get them, they can use them to trace
and
your network.
And it doesn't require you to actually click on the link in all cases. Opening the password could be sufficient.
Yeah, I would say it's more limited. I'm going to demo in the talk today one where the person simply opens the email in preview mode, but that is a more of a rarity, and it takes a special vulnerability that when... So Microsoft learned about this particular vulnerability and closed it with a patch. The problem is it's an optional patch, and almost no one applies it. So
especially if you're not running the current systems, right?
Yeah, but I mean, even what's amazing is just Microsoft knows about it. The patch is out there, and people still don't apply
it. I bet less than half the people have actually been protected at this point.
Maybe less than 1%.
Really? How long has the fix been out there?
Almost a year.
Wow. That's...
But because they made it optional and they're like, well, you should use a firewall and block it. And you need to do this. Anytime you make anything optional, though, it just doesn't get done. What I will say, though, is most of the time it takes someone clicking on a link. With that said, it's not that hard to trick someone to clicking on a link. And I can even send you, there's another one of the presentations I show is where it looks like a hair or a piece of dust.
I was going to say, you called it clickjacking.
Clickjacking. Yeah. So that is where an attacker sends you an email or a web page where they tell you, oh, click on here, and it's something that you want to do. And as you go to move your mouse cursor, at the last second it switches out and puts another button or something else. It is hijacking your mouse click, and you're accidentally clicking on something else that you didn't intend to do.
Or I think you gave the example, they may purposely have an image that looks like it's got some dust or dirt on the screen.
So most of the browser manufacturers, Microsoft and Google, have spent lots of money stopping clickjacking. So that they couldn't change the focus of control. So what some attackers started to do is make it look like it's a hair or a piece of dust, and especially on today's touch screens where, I don't know how many times we've all been looking at our screen going, oh, there's a piece of dust or something. You go to kind of wipe it away, but it really is a picture. And when they hit that, it activates the link and could be sending the password hash.
That's amazing. And another phrase that I was not familiar with, password sprays, which is kind of more of a wholesale approach to doing
that. Yeah, this is actually very, very popular today. And that is where attackers will have 1,000 or 10,000 common passwords, and they'll use it across your entire user base. So they'll learn...
You being...
A company.
Okay.
So it could be, it could be a bank, a credit union, could be, a large company like Microsoft. I think the statistics are is that 87% of companies will have employees that have passwords that will be on those common password lists. So as long as they...
80-20 rule. I guess if they've got a list of 1,000, you're going to get a bunch. Yeah,
so as long as they get a good list of your employees' email addresses, they're going to be successful getting through. You got to have a list of email addresses, a large list of email addresses to guess against, and you have to have an online portal. So that could be like your email portal or VPN login, something like that. And when they put the combination of the online portal is accessible over the internet, and during the talk, I actually gave some presentations to show how you can just do Google lookups, right, and find that sort of stuff for different companies. I think I find one for Tesla in the talk. But then you just put the password, get one of these password spray tools, and you're able to get a foothold into the company. And usually from the time an attacker breaks in and has just one login name and password, it's only a matter of a couple of hours till they break and take over the entire environment. As a matter of fact, Russia is documented as having the fastest time from the initial break-in to complete ownership of the environment, 8 minutes.
Wow. I'm starting to see why some companies get as paranoid as to lock down where you can't even log in by VPN or whatnot.
One of my next talks, I'm not doing it here, but one of my next talks is called From Email Address to Complete PON, or Ownership of Your Environment.
Yeah.
I'm going to take people that attend that are going to see it step by step of how the real attackers do it.
One of the other things I saw in your presentation, the notion of rogue recoveries, I thought was interesting too. And I thought you had a tip that I'd never heard before, that you should not provide your security question, prompts, your answers. You shouldn't make them the real answer, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, the password reset questions or the reset questions are the worst form of authentication and should be outlawed. Whoever thought
because you can socially engineer and find out the answers?
Well, couple of things. One is, whoever thought that your mother's maiden name was some type of protected secret nobody could find.
That's the first place I ever got nailed was, and it was apparently somebody, there was a mole when my first mortgage application came in. Mother's maiden name comes right off it. They were writing in my credit cards.
So it's horrible. Google did a study and showed something like 40% of people that supply the right questions or right answers to their own accounts can't remember them. And something like 20% of people's questions could be answered from information easily available to anyone. 80% could be answered by people, by the attackers, then looking through a person's social media or something like that. So my hint is that you should treat any password reset question or recovery question as if it was a password. So don't put in the real answer. It says, mother's maiden name, dog. You know,
the problem with that is trying to figure out which, you know.
You have to write it down. Yeah. I use a password manager to keep track of them.
I've always wondered about that. What happens if someone hacks the password manager?
Well, they could have the keys to the kingdom. But that really, you know, in order for them to get to hack the password manager, most of the time they have to be able to hack the workstation. If they've hacked your workstation to the extent they can get your password manager, they can just key log you.
You got bigger problems.
Other things. Yeah. Now, I do think, let me say, I'm a fan of password managers. I do think as they become more widely used that they're going to be successfully attacked.
They'll become the honeypot.
You know, worms and Trojans will go after them. Right now, worms and Trojans go after internet browser password caches. The password managers aren't attacked nearly that much. And they have a couple other things that kind of protect them a little bit beyond what a browser would, such as, you know, maybe the private key that's needed to unlock it's stored in the cloud or something like that. So there are, but it's a valid point. We're just moving risk and
choose your poison. Yeah. The one other thing I noticed in your deck, Rogue Forms.
The Rogue Forms is pretty cool. There's always been this ability that in your email client, especially in Outlook and some other email clients that have these forms and templates, if an attacker can get to them, they can modify them so that when you receive a particular email that it then does some malicious action. Although for a lot of years it took compromising the workstation, now there's a tool called Ruler that I demonstrate that if you have the person's email address and password, they can actually install a rogue form that installs a backdoor Trojan. So literally, I'm going to show people in the video, literally it takes seconds for me to install a remote backdoor Trojan on your computer through email, and all I had was your email address and password, which is not that hard to get. And matter of fact, we can do that by cracking the hash and doing a fake hair, a piece of dust.
And I saw something, one of the little telltale signs to watch for are a couple extra slash marks around file names.
So that isn't in the rogue form per se. That's really in that one where I can get still. If you get an email that comes in and the URL has file:4 and then 4 forward slashes, that for sure is a malicious hackable thing. But that's the secret of how do I get your password hash across the internet. I send you an email that has a picture or a link in it that has file:\\\\\, and ends up kicking off the SMB NetBIOS protocol. Back in Internet Explorer 5.0, Microsoft shut down the ability for the Windows integrated password hash to be sent across the internet, but they forgot to shut down this NetBIOS avenue. Now, the reason why people don't apply the patch, besides it being optional, is that many networks today work because of it, and when people apply the patches, it breaks their internal distributed network. Wow. So you can't just willy-nilly apply it. So they've got a patch that's optional, somewhat complex, probably in most cases causes more harm than good for a lot of companies. So it means no one's applying it. Kevin Mitnick, our chief hacking officer and a co-owner of KnowBe4, he doesn't like me talking about it because he loves to use it with his internal.
Oh, Kevin is at KnowBe4.
Yep.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, he's at KnowBe4. He's the chief hacking officer. But he said, Roger, you keep talking about it. It's one of my favorite hacks that I use to break into places. Yeah. He doesn't want it to become a required mandatory patch.
So anytime there's 4 slashes, does it mean get your guard up? Are there positive reasons to use that, or is that always a sign of something nefarious?
It could be used legitimately. I mean, again.
But these days, if you see it, you really ought to.
Yeah. I would say I would be highly suspicious of it. And I myself, after testing, if you've got people, listeners, always test before you follow what Roger says. But I would be highly suspicious, and I personally would have no problem just blocking any link that had that. I would search for those links, rewrite them, block them, whatever, because most of the time they're going to be malicious.
Interesting. So if people want to find out more, KnowBe4, obviously, and also your own books, what's the best way to follow?
You know, if you go to knowbe4.com/resources, there's
and again,
a lot
of- this is the word know, B-E, the letter 4.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yep. KnowBe4.com, and the number 4 at the end, /resources. We've got a lot of cool tools there, including where tools that you can run to see if your passwords are out there on the internet.
Oh, nice.
Your today's passwords are out there on the internet. Plus, there's a really cool link to one of my favorite talks, which is called Hacking 12 Ways to Hack 2FA, which has been a really popular topic. Because a lot of times people say, well, if you want to stop these email attacks, just use multi-factor authentication. I've come up with 18 ways to hack multi-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. It's actually probably going to be my next book from Wiley after the current one that I'm working
on. Great. We'll put a link directly to that because I think that's worth
it. And certainly go to Amazon and look for any of my books, Roger A. Grimes.
Well, Roger, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Glenn.
You know, we cannot go without mentioning, I thought your joint presentation, I don't even know if it's called a presentation because I don't think there were any slides, with Brian Lay of AlphaRank was awesome.
Thank you.
I mean, I like listening to both of you talk, but there was something about the way the two of you interacted on stage.
I really thought that would be okay. You know, this year I wanted to work with another great mind, and he truly is a great mind.
I really enjoy. When you talk about geekery, the fact that he's talked about this before. He recently got married. His wedding ring is a fitness tracker.
He
literally has a chip in so he can use it for fitness tracking. If that's not, next generation geekery, I don't know what.
It really is. And for those of you who don't know who we're talking about, it's Brian Lay, the CEO of AlphaRank. We have a podcast with him as well. He is, really just a deep thinker in a lot of ways, in the sense of how can we, work on networking, cultural networking, and really sees the world through a lens of connected people and connected humans.
And we've had him on the podcast before as well. And again, a true entrepreneur in the right spirit, he's pivoted the company. He had a very strong idea about how to use that information about networks, and he discovered that it really wasn't, at least at this stage of the game, practical for all but the largest institutions. So he took his idea and pivoted it and is going after a different angle.
And that's what we talked about.
Yeah.
It was really, your artificial intelligence is only as good as your AI. And the idea was that there's so much data in the credit union that's all over the place. But what you don't realize is to really get the good answers out of these algorithms, you need all that data. And it seems trivial, like, oh, we'll get a report from these guys. And that's great for once. But this is what Brian's talking is a cycle, continuously doing this, because that's how you're going to, what he wanted to do was hack deposit growth.
Yeah.
And he believes that the answer to that.
And that seems to be what is keeping most executives up at night.
Yeah.
Along with fear about interest rates and fear about, cyber hijacking and whatnot. But it's pretty darn high on the list.
Yeah. And my thought, my portion of it was really talking about how to identify these trends. We talked about transformational moments.
Mm-hmm.
The moment at some point there were cars and horse and buggies same road. Yeah.
Which we're coming up on all over again with the cars,
autonomous,
and the driverless cars.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have a great picture of a driverless car we'll put in the notes. And there's a bunch of people driving, and they're way behind this guy.
You just don't want to get too close.
Yeah, but I didn't enjoy the cop that pulled over the driverless car. I wonder what he thought, license and registration. Wait, where are you? He got away.
And there was somebody in the car, right? Because he always had, the law says.
Yeah, right now.
Talk about, regulations. You got to be in the newspaper.
But I'd be in the passenger seat going, what means?
Awesome. Exactly, not me.
Here's the car. Right, so interesting.
Well, and the conversation was so good that you had to stop before you ran out of time. One of the things you guys planned to do was to do kind of a debate format about the power and the dangers of AI. And you kind of, you gamed it a bit because, you wanted to both take positions that were far enough apart.
Right.
I think in some cases you were kind of exaggerating.
Yeah.
But what we did was you and Brian then got up with our friends at CU Broadcast, Mike Lawson, and actually did that on a video. We'll post the link to that.
As soon as we get it,
Bonus kind of follow up with that one. I think you'll really enjoy hearing Brian and John go at it.
Yep.
Kind of on a similar, maybe more like with the Roger Grimes fears of things as well. And I know you've got an affiliation with Borsetta, right?
Right, right.
And Pamela Norton did a breakout session that I attended and really enjoyed what she had to say as well.
Yeah, so Pamela's a friend. Her husband is actually in the credit union community, has been for years. That's how I know her. And, she's a very successful entrepreneur. And what was interesting was she kind of turned me on to this idea that we have a huge problem with counterfeits to start off with. So
mentioned that if you go to Amazon, I think it's 80 or 90% of the supposedly Apple branded products really aren't.
Yeah, 1 out of 5.
Yeah.
You could honestly get a counterfeit iPhone. You could be using one right now, as far as you know.
If you bought it.
If you bought an unlocked one, it wasn't directly from AT&T. I thought that was fascinating. I thought the other thing that was very fascinating from my perspective was the idea that we're going to have to deal with this continuous intrusion from building our products overseas. There has been a fallout from us taking all our chip manufacturing. And what you talked about was Spectre. And so for those of you that don't remember, last year it was identified that specifically the Chinese had put something in our chips. You know, they're used for everything from toasters to refrigerators to your computers. That was basically spying on us.
And this is, I mean, she never used the word Huawei, but I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about.
That's 5G. Huawei, right, Huawei. With 5G, that's a big fear. And so with that in mind, you know, we had a discussion around, well, what is it going to mean to truly register an asset in the mm-hmm. future?
And I'm going to, before we steal her thunder, I had a conversation with her, and she got into the detail around what Borsetta is doing on that front.
Well, let's let her roll.
Great.
Glenn Cervata here at the end of day one of the AXFI conference with Pamela Norton, the founder and CEO of Borsetta. And she did a presentation, I think it was just before lunch, which freaked me out.
Are you ready to move to Montana?
And I won't necessarily say,
get off the grid.
I can't just say in a good way. It was fascinating and it was valuable, but it didn't give me a warm fuzzy
right.
about security and about chips and about the way we actually, and the thing that kept coming to my mind, the thing that's top of mind in the headlines right now is Huawei with the full 5G and the ability to be certain that the infrastructure isn't somehow being compromised from the inside.
From the inside.
So exactly. Can you say a bit about what you do with Borsetta and what your mission is?
Yeah. So our mission is, our biggest mission in life is to defeat counterfeit and fraud, right? I mean, that's how we set out a couple years ago initially in the luxury goods industry. So
you mentioned, I think one of the data points you had, the number of like Apple products listed on Amazon that are actually counterfeits.
What's interesting is if you look at the growth of counterfeit and fraud, right, it's out of control. It's $1.7 trillion. Dollars
wow.
right now annually, and it's growing to $4.7 trillion. I think there was a stat, the government ran a research project a year ago on the top five U.S. Websites, and they found that over 48 or 49% of the products they purchased were counterfeit.
And the higher
Amazon
price,
is, of course,
the higher the luxury item, the more attractive it is for counterfeiters, obviously, as well. But even more disturbing, as you pointed out, is the number of counterfeit parts going into things like fighter jets.
Yeah, fighter jets. Yeah, right. Because it's 20% of parts, right, replacement parts that are being procured right now by the Department of Defense.
Which is just, I mean, remarkable both because of the mission critical aspect and the fact that the Department of Defense themselves are having a hard time cracking
this
code.
Yeah. And so what the government in a lot of different areas they've been doing is they're trying to rapidly prototype technologies to bring it in. And, you know, everyone knows the procurement cycle is so long within the government and that most emerging companies are just, you know, you don't have the money to spend 18 months to try to get a project, right? It's just very difficult. And so what they're doing right now is they have some significant issues with counterfeit and fraud, specifically at the chip level. Right. So today, 50% of all microprocessing chips, right?
These would be the ones in our phones, in our smartphones.
Right. Are produced outside the United States in untrusted facilities. And so
by definition, if outside the US, untrusted, or some of those are vetted appropriately?
Are vetted, but yet there's a lot of areas where Trojans and malware can be added in. They can easily clone. They can easily overproduce. So you have issues with all the IP owners, right, of whether it's ARM or Synopsys or, you know, any of the large companies that own IP that's on the chip itself is not secured, right? So the designs have been stolen, right? And so there's just a lot of issues around, you think about it's at the core of all of our important systems. It's buying our digital economy.
And again, it could be a sleeper cell because you don't know when and how it will be activated.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened, we came across an opportunity where the Air Force was looking for a solution for a chip, 14 nanometer, which means it's a very small chip. Right?
You gave the comparison, like you could put it on Abraham Lincoln's nose.
One of the other chips that's a track and trace is so tiny. It's like a speck if you were to, see Lincoln's nose on a penny.
But that's not the one we're talking about here. These are visible.
Yeah, visible. Okay. Very, but still extremely small. And so what's happening is we're putting more and more, we're needing more and more information at the chip level. We need it to process more efficiently, right? We need it to be able to sense the environment, do so many things, whether it's a chip for an autonomous vehicle or a drone. And so because of that, the chips are getting smaller, right? Because mm-hmm. they're trying to be more efficient. And so GlobalFoundries here in the United States is the last fabricating foundry, you know, that's here.
Upstate New York?
Upstate New York. Mm-hmm. So they are what's considered really, truly the last trusted facility.
From a U.S. Security Department of Defense type standpoint.
Right, right. So the goal for this challenge that we applied to was, what is your solution for a 14-nanometer chip for an autonomous, any type of autonomous device that we can verify not only the provenance of it, we can track and trace it through the supply chain, and it's also extremely secure, right?
I think I hear the phrase blockchain on a chip?
Yeah,
basically.
Right. Yeah. AI vision, yeah. Blockchain chip, yeah. And so we, alongside, I think, eight other companies were awarded the next phase. So we're in the design phase of this chip right now.
You're competing with each other or collaborating?
Everybody has a different concept.
Different piece,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, which is great. And again, their whole intent is how can we rapidly prototype and secure this chip, right? So this chip that we've designed, we could actually produce it in any facility around the world and not have a concern, right?
I'm not sure I follow that. Why is this chip okay to produce elsewhere and not have that non-trusted issue?
Yeah, no, it's great. So we have like some really interesting secret sauce that goes into the chip.
You have to kill me. Okay.
Yeah, great. <Got right. it. laughs> And there are some secret trust anchors that get embedded. Okay. And there's also some metering technology that goes in that you can't overproduce the chip, right? So there's some interesting markers that can't be identified unless you have, again, some interesting devices to be able to validate it. So,
but the basic idea, as I understand it, was to digitize the supply chain, what you're really trying to track from inception through to the end user.
Yeah.
And that has, obviously, you're working on this on a grant from the Department of Defense, but has applications much more broadly.
Right, exactly. And we feel like if we can create a new standard protocol, if you will, for a trusted physical asset at the chip level, right, then we can help other industries, right? We can help ensure that all Americans or global citizens, right, that the chip that's in my phone or the chip that's, you know, giving my insulin to me, right? I have control at the chip level, right? And I can determine who has authorization for my data, right? And so it's, you know, we're at a very important time. I think this is such a critical time in our, in life, right? Because everything is moving so fast, right? We have robots showing up at, you know, the Sheridan, you know, at the LAX that's delivering, you know, your pillows.
Yeah, the
to,
room
you
service.
Know, room
I remember
service,
that presentation,
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we turn around and we're just like, we're so now dependent on devices. How do we know the information's secure, right? How do we know that, again, we have big tech, they're taking over everything?
The comment you made that really struck me is, I mean, obviously the financial system is based on trust to a great extent. And your point was it's hard to hold on to that trust if you don't control the hardware, assuming that we're no longer, you know, to the extent we're moving out of the branch onto the handset. Well, again, if you don't know what's in that handset.
Right, right. Or what's in the Alexa that you're speaking to when you're trying to transfer money. And so, you know, there's a concern you have these, you know, digital identities, these digital twins, right? And so all of our information has been stolen. Right. I mean, our data has been breached how many times, right? And we know that there are bad sources out there that want to recreate our identities. They can take our photos, they can take our voice, and they can become this digital twin, right, of whatever device I have. So when you start really thinking about, you know, we're so focused right now on the cloud and securing everything in the cloud, well, all of this intelligence is moving down
it's
to
resident,
the device, right? And so now this edge economy, right?
Yeah, you use that phrase edge economy. I really want to make sure because it was new to me. I think I started
new.
To get
I
it.
I made it up.
You did? Oh, I like it. Okay.
And so what I see happening is you're going to have machine-to-machine. You have machine-to-machine transactions, right? And you'll eventually have people-to-people, right? So I'll have a, you know, mm-hmm. you and I will transact, right? And we don't need a middleman to trust the transaction that just happened. So you have an entire new layer of commerce now that's going to be happening directly from these machines, right? Whether it's data being sent or transmitted or photos being transacted, right? That are being, you know, like my drone service, right? Is, you know, transacting all these photos or whatever videos, right? So now I'm billing my clients, right? So the machines itself will be not only validating, right? But you'll have ledgers, right? On that, mm-hmm. on that device that is documenting those transactions, right? That have happened. So instead of all of that going back to the cloud, right? Going back to these servers, it's going to be at the device level.
Got it.
So what's going to happen? Who's going to be the processing authority, right?
And that was one of the things you mentioned that you need to, we need to find a standard here, because
right.
obviously it's your typical network effect problem.
Right.
You've got to have the chip in place that people trust, and yeah. people have to be stand ready to trust that chip.
Right.
And yeah. that's again why, I mean, again, you're right now your main, you know, use case is with the Department of Defense mm-hmm. and defense contracting, but here you are at a financial services conference. Mm-hmm. So your goal right now is to build the awareness to get people kind of ready to hopefully look for these yeah. types of standards and
exactly.
be, you know, prepared to use these types of services.
To start supporting and to be a voice that is, we understand that these devices are going to be part, they already are part of our everyday. And how are we ensuring not only my ID is a sovereign ID, right, that no one has access to, but my ID is attached to all these unique IDs of physical objects, right, that are mine, and that I should be able, again, to have control. And so that's really the vision. If we don't start educating people now, we don't start creating awareness, and we don't start driving that standard, we're going to lose this window.
Yeah, you're trying to just get ahead of that curve and make sure
yeah.
that awareness exists
yeah.
outside DOD.
Yeah, right.
So if people, is your website at this point communicating these issues beyond defense? Or what's if people want to find out
yeah.
more, what's the best way to find out?
They can go to Borsetta.io,
Borsetta.io.
We are still under the radar.
Okay.
So a lot of that's not communicated on the website.
Got
and
it.
We will have some updates coming soon. And we also, again, are really trying to engage with businesses as well as the community to really, again, ensure that our, whether it's our corporate assets are secured, our private personal assets are secured, is just, it's really a momentum that we want to drive here. Because again, we've lost control. Mm-hmm. There's no trust, there is no control. And again, you know, we're given these devices and we're just told, hey, trust them, you know, they're getting your medical stuff, don't worry
yeah.
about it. And
so
we know what happens with that, right?
See the science fiction plots just
yeah, right.
Black Mirror.
Black
whatever,
Mirror
yeah.
is all over, yeah.
So the Department of Defense, obviously here financial services, any other specific kind of sectors that you're focusing your early awareness campaigns on?
You know, we're certainly interested in the whole pharmaceutical because, you
of
know,
course.
A huge
healthcare.
You know, corruption of just
well, and the yeah, whole idea, like you say, I mean, if someone tried to hack, you know, pacemakers, insulin
yeah.
delivery devices,
yeah.
you can
yeah.
wreak a whole bunch of
yeah.
havoc if
yeah.
you want to just
right.
think about worst
yeah.
case scenarios.
Yeah. So we're looking at kind of those systems that are responsible for, you know, the health and welfare of, you know, our citizens.
Makes
and,
sense.
And then, you know, obviously there's tremendous opportunity when you look at the energy grids, you know, you look at all of our infrastructure systems.
This ties together
yeah.
nicely to Peter Singer's
yes.
presentation about the cybersecurity strategic plan
yeah.
and whatnot. I mean,
yeah.
the natural things you have to be thinking
idea
about.
Yeah, is just trying to have people start donating their time and being a task force
yeah.
to say, you know, wait, our water systems, to our energy grids, this is the future of war, right?
It starts feeling a little bit like
know.
World War II. Everybody's
mm-hmm.
got a hand to play. It's time
yeah.
to just kind of
yeah.
give it the
yeah.
office.
Yeah. So,
well, Pamela Norton,
yes.
thanks so much. This is
Thank
this is really
so
interesting.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to be following along as you come out from under the radar
yes.
and follow up a little bit more
great.
About this.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Well, you know, Pam is a great speaker, by the way. I don't know if you noticed that, but
she's
really good at telling this story.
She clearly knows her stuff.
She does. And, you know, she's a little out of her element, but that's what I want.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting here, too, is she made it very clear that, you know, this is not something, and it's a little bit like quantum computing. It's not something credit unions need to be worrying about now, but if we don't get in front of it, we're going to be playing catch up. So it's more the awareness, because we're going to want to make sure that these phones that people are interacting with their credit unions on are properly authorized.
Right.
And if we don't at least have a say in that verification process up front,
right,
it's going to be a problem.
Well, it also affects our choices right now as far as vendors, right? So if you're talking to a vendor and you say, hey, how aware are you guys of, you know, we had Pure IT on as the last piece here. He's talking about VDI, which is virtual desktop integration, which is a fantastic concept. The challenge is not every software vendor supports it, right? So if that's a way you're going, then your first question to any potential vendor is, do you support VDI? And in this case, you know, it's a similar concept. Hey, we're looking at this high-level phone app. You know, we're talking to this mobile company. Hey, guys, we know this isn't right now, but what are your feelings around, you know, using hardware-based, you know, identification systems, you know, maybe tracking the sealed ledger? And if they go, we don't know what you're talking about, okay, well, maybe you want to put a little notch next to that partner. You
or
know?
At least get them to start thinking about it if you're really committed to it.
Right. And so, you know, and those are the times during the implementation. I think that the wrap-up, my main takeaway from this is always the same. All the speakers that we had are always fantastic, but the real meat of this thing is, and you saw it last night, I think we have a very active community as it relates to the obligatory cocktail hour that you have to have, but man, you can't hear yourself in there because everybody's just really getting together. To me, that's the most important part of this concept.
The networking.
Of this is the networking.
I know I came away with at least four new people that I definitely want to have ongoing conversations with.
And that's what I want to amplify in this. And it was Paul's vision when he started with me. Trellence carries that same philosophy. And we want to even drive that further. You know, if you come here, it's not a bunch of chairs all lined up in a parallel row facing a speaker. It's a bunch of tables.
Yep.
So that when you sit down, you're looking at someone else across the table. And you at least got to say hi, you know, because there's plenty of time between the speakers. And that's purposeful because really the speakers to me are just fodder for the conversations I want to happen during dinners and during the cocktail hours and around the booths and, you know, or in the private meetings that people have. And, you know, I know for me, that's always been the real power of a conference is the relationships then.
And you've got more of that coming up just now with the Innovation Club.
We do.
The fun's not done yet.
The fun's not done yet. And we have a really cool... We also, and we should just leave it at this, we'll do a bigger, longer podcast on this, but we introduced big training.
That's right. That's
so
right.
If you go to big.cu/training, we'll train you in Agile. We'll have online video training for digital strategy. We'll have online video training for machine learning. We'll have online training for, you know, executive type features and strategies with Kirk Kordaleski. We're really going all in on the training thing because what we're realizing is, much like Brian Lay, that if we don't train people, it's no good. You know, to introduce them to these strategies and these concepts because they need to be able to understand how to use them.
And it'll not leave you feeling like a zombie. That's my little teaser.
Yeah, the zombie.
Another extra reason to go take a look at the video.
The zombie piece is cool. So at JB FinTech, if you want to find me on Twitter.
At 154 Advisors. John, I know you got more content from the show as well, from this event as well.
I do.
We'll find a way, whether on audio, I know some of yours is video too, so we'll have that up there in some fashion, either, you know, immediately or in another podcast coming up soon. Until then, every Tuesday, new content here on the BigCast.
Thanks. Take care, everyone.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big FinTech. Email us at info@big-fintech.com. Or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.